The Rio Plus 20 Earth Summit came to a close last Friday with a final declaration that environmental journalist George Monbiot called 283 paragraphs a fluff. Monbiot's lament on the tepidly titled document, The Future We Want, is common among those surveying the lack of results from the week-long climate change summit, attended by participants from 130 nations, but missing key world elements. Key world leaders, that is. Representative from Nicaragua, Miguel Descoto Brockman, said the final Rio Plus 20 agreement, quote, contributes almost nothing to our struggle to survive as a species. The 2012 Earth Summit came 20 years after the precedent-setting 1992 gathering, also in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, that led to a concerted global effort to address climate change resulting in the Kyoto Protocol. However, Janet Redman of the Institute for Policy Studies writes that each summit failed to address what she called the two elephants in the room, the energy consumption of developed nations and the problems of unlimited growth and finite resources. Her colleague Oscar Reyes watched Rio 2012 come to a close without nations committing to any binding agreements or ambitious targets. Reyes sees a silver lining in language that reaffirmed a commitment to decreasing dependence on fossil fuels and a de-emphasis of the corporate-driven green economy agenda that threatens to put a price tag on all natural resources. Janet Redman is the co-director of the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network at the Institute for Policy Studies. She now joins me on the phone. Welcome to Uprising, Janet.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, were there high hopes for this conference given the precedent in previous conferences?
No, I mean, I think this is one of the interesting kind of reasons why things didn't move forward very well at Rio Plus 20. In fact, many people who were involved very deeply in the process, but also watching the process from civil society from outside the negotiating halls leading up to the meeting just now, really were feeling like this isn't the right time. This is an urgent time for environmental action and for economic action, but it's not a time when multilateral processes have proved themselves very well, and so there isn't much of an appetite globally for a new set of multilateral processes. So there were very low expectations. I think a piece of it, though, was also that particular governments were trying to lower people's expectations. The U.S. government, in fact, has been guilty of this and many other fora, not just in the Rio Plus 20 Earth Summit. But for this, they were trying to downgrade it from a summit to a gathering, to a meeting, trying to actually take some of the official weight away from global leaders coming together. I think, again, being someone who lives in the U.S. and pays taxes in the U.S., it's disappointing that we didn't even send our leader, we didn't even send President Obama, while many other leaders of countries came to Rio to talk to one another about the most pressing issues of the day. So the failure, in a sense, was almost predetermined because of the lack of a weight that some very important governments, the U.S., the U.K., and others, gave to the
The Guardian's Fiona Harvey, writing about the summit, explained that when the agreements were being discussed, the parts that were not agreed upon by everybody were put in square brackets in the drafts. And Brazil, the host of the conference, essentially removed all of these parts from the text that were in square brackets, and there was no discussion about it, in order to at least claim that this summit that they were hosting was some kind of a success because there was agreement, as opposed to what happened in 2009 in Copenhagen. Can you comment on that?
Well, yeah. I mean, when you watch multilateral negotiations, bracketed text is very common thing that happens. That's just the text that people don't agree on. And bracketed text often doesn't make it into final statements or final agreements in multilateral processes. In a sense, that's why this outcome document was not a convention. There wasn't a new creation of a new process or new infrastructure necessarily. Really, what we ended up with was, you know, a statement of commitment in theory to things that had already been committed to 20 years ago. So yes, there was a real kind of moving to the lowest common denominator of what could be agreed upon, which we, in Copenhagen, we saw an outcome, but again, it was a relatively weak outcome, and people were, many people feel that countries were strong-armed into agreeing to something they didn't agree to. So in one sense, at least there wasn't language included in this outcome of Rio that countries felt strong-armed into having to go along with. So I think that's, in a sense, a positive, but it did mean that there were very weak statements made there. There were plans to do stuff. For example, there's a plan to work on some sustainable development goals and to start that conversation and reach that by 2015. So again, it's not doing it now. It's talking about doing it later. There was conversation and language around cutting fossil fuel subsidies. So, but unfortunately, it wasn't nuanced in the sense that we need to cut production subsidies to oil, gas, coal companies in the global north. But leave in place and fully phase out consumption subsidies for people who are needing basic energy access in the global south. So again, there was by reaching a kind of watered down agreement, there was a sense of moving forward in a common direction. And there were some pieces that were sprinkled within the document that are interesting hooks for later action. But I think what's really interesting about what's in there is that it basically just gives a framework or an overarching narrative to things that are already going on anyway. For example, the World Bank launched a new program about valuing ecosystem services globally, particularly in the global south, as a way to have governments be able to, in a sense, privatize, commodify their natural resources as part of their wealth base. On one hand, you can look at this as an example of a management tool. If you know how much its value is worth to people, then you can protect it well. It also means, of course, you could sell it off because now that value has a monetary, a price tag on it. So there were kind of frameworks that were established in this document that actually allow those kinds of work that's going forward in other institutions anyway to have some cover. And I think that's actually the danger. Whether anything was agreed upon or not, whether there were new conventions or not, is almost less important than the narrative that allows privatization of natural resources, the idea of unlimited growth on a finite planet, to move forward in a way that doesn't question the underlying problem that we can't continue to grow like we grow, we can't continue to consume like we consume in the north, and think that we can live on a planet that's healthy and have communities that are healthy.
Were there any dissenters, particularly representatives of island nations that are seeing climate change effects, that are on the front lines, if you will, of climate change?
I mean, I think like in the UN space, many times the least developed countries particularly in sub-Saharan Africa and those small island developing states have been the voice of reason and the voice of, you know, ecological sanity in these multilateral processes. And those are strong voices that people do listen to. Unfortunately, you can't put a blanket over, for example, all the small island developing states. Sometimes what they're looking for isn't useful. I think we've seen in the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, the climate summits, that some island states say we have to kind of do whatever we can right now to make sure that greenhouse gases are reduced. That includes things like carbon trading, which actually don't reduce greenhouse gases. They just shift the responsibility around to other nations. So I think there's a cautionary tale there about using the idea of urgency to pass policies that are, in the long run, inequitable. And I think inequitable policies around things like climate change and around ecological destruction in general will ultimately mean that they won't be effective. Because if they're inequitable, if they make it so that folks in developing countries can't access basic services, can't develop, because they're not actually addressing overconsumption in the global north, then it's going to be unlikely that countries who are still facing the challenge of meeting people's basic needs are going to actually comply with those commitments or even those rhetorical rhetorical agreements.
Janet Redmond, were there corporations represented at the summit as well? I mean, were they allowed to essentially openly lobby government representatives and affect the final draft that was agreed to?
Well, many times the private sector is a part of national delegations.
So each country brings their own delegates?
Yes, sometimes they can be delegates. And often civil society can be delegates of country delegations as well. So there are oftentimes seats open to in parties to multiple sectors. I think the part where you see a lot of the private sector's influence is in the hallways, but also in some of the spaces where receptions are held, where side events are held, where people mingle, because that's a lot of where decisions are made. People arrived at the Rio summit actually with text in hand. So most of the work of negotiating the line by line pieces of this outcome were actually done, in a sense, behind the scenes or in the hallways or in other places. There were open preparatory committee meetings that happened in the UN and happened in other spaces, actually happened in Rio before the summit. But a lot of conversation happened among people that know each other well. And in this case, oftentimes the leaders of the private sector are folks that know finance ministries and have been in finance ministries or are influencing environmental ministries. So there's a lot of kind of people shifting and creeping around between different roles in these multilateral spaces. And that's a place that's very hard for us to put our finger on, in a sense, because they happen in informal spaces as well as formal spaces.
Now, in the last few days, one piece of news here in the United States addressing climate change is a silver lining. And I'm wondering if you think that this is the wave of the future with the U.S. Court of Appeals, a three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals ruling just yesterday that the Environmental Protection Agency here in the U.S. is indeed allowed to regulate greenhouse gases according to the Clean Air Act, or using the framework of the Clean Air Act that had been challenged by industries. And I'm wondering if you think that this is the way in which any action on climate change is going to have to occur within, you know, countries rather than these international summits where nothing seems to get done.
Yeah, I think it's an important place. I think there are kind of three levels where action needs to happen. I think absolutely the ruling that the EPA was handed down is critical. And I think that we as people who vote in the U.S. need to continue to push both congressionally to make sure those powers aren't taken away, and we need to make our voices heard in every possible way we can toward the administration and toward all sectors of government, that it's absolutely unacceptable for regulatory agencies not to be able to do their jobs. So I think that was a great success. But I still think that multilateral spaces are critical in no small part because the problem we're dealing with is a cross-boundary, a trans-boundary problem. And so there have to be places where countries come together and have a conversation across political boundaries. At the same time, I think a lot of action is going to have to happen in countries at the state and local level. So that's kind of where the rubber hits the road. And that's true in the United States as well. We've seen some interesting activity in California in particular. I think that's a model state, many of us feel, for taking action at a state level and, you know, in a sense at a regional level because it's such a big state. But we will need to see a lot more action at the local level. And we've seen things like the Conference of Mayors come together around green cities. We've seen civil society networks pop up around things like local food systems. So I think all three of those levels, local, national, and multilateral international spaces, are critical, and we have to figure out how we, of course, allocate our resources between them, but we can't lose sight of any of those three levels.
Janet Redmond, give out a website for the Institute for Policy Studies.
Absolutely. You can find us at www.ips-dc.org.
That's ips-dc.org. We'll post that on uprisingradio.org later today. Janet, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Janet Redmond is co-director of the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network at the Institute for Policy Studies. For Sonali, subversive thought for the day, Confucius once said, "When it is obvious that the goals cannot be reached, don't adjust the goals, adjust the action steps." That's Confucius. That's Sonali's subversive thought for the day.